order of the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is February 13th, 2012, and we are convened for a variety of public hearings and possible work sessions as well as work sessions. To give the people who have come to testify an idea of where we are going to go in the proceedings, we will first start with a work session on Senate Bill 1552, and if Senator George is here in time, we'll go to Senate Bill 1564, then we'll go to Senate Bill 1548, then we will go to Senate Bill 1502 for the public hearing, and then we will go to Senate Bill 1587, and then concluding with Senate Bill 1521, and somewhere along the way we'll plug in a work session for Senate Bill 1518, depending on if we get the paperwork back from legislative fiscal. So that being said, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1552. Jan, could you tee it up for us, and Senator Rosenbaum, be ready for the motion?
I am. Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 1552 was heard by the committee last week. This is the bill that sets up a mediation program for foreclosures. And you had before you then a dash one amendment that sets up a $100 fee for the financial institution when they're filing a notice of default. And it exempts from the fee those financial institutions that have commenced fewer than 250 foreclosures during the past 12-month period. Directs the Attorney General to appoint a mediation service provider to coordinate the program, and it directs the Attorney General to enter into an agreement to pay for the mediation service provider from the proceeds of that $100 fee. Directs the Attorney General to set by rule the schedule of fees. The Dash 2 amendment exempts from the mediation requirement those beneficiaries who have not commenced more than 250 foreclosures in the last 12-month period, and the Dash 3 amendment adds an operative date that's 91 days after the effective date. There is no revenue impact on the original bill on the amendments, and there is a fiscal impact statement for the Dash 1 amendment and a minimal fiscal impact statement issued for the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments.
Quick question, Mr. Chair. Technical
yes.
question.
Senator Boquist.
Are 1, 2, and 3, are there any conflicts between the two of those? And you said fiscal, so does this have a subsequent referral in any manner?
Mr. Chair, there is no referral to Ways and Means, and there are no conflicts with the amendments that I know of.
And if I recall, the fiscal was below the line. That was the rationale.
Mr. Chair, it says that there's a minimal impact to counties and clerks. It talks about an expense to the Attorney General for startup costs, unknown foreseeable fiscal impacts, for the mediation activities and the fee from the filers. But no subsequent referral was raised by the fiscal office when they prepared the statement.
All right. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume, Jan, I need to do separate motions on each of these amendments?
That's correct. The committee hadn't adopted them last week at all.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1552.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1552. Is there any discussion?
Just to thank Robles. The other committee members for Senator Beyer and I.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment.
First,
we have to vote on it.
Further discussion? Seeing none.
I think we can do unanimous, can't we? Because it's an amendment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you asked for discussion. Any
yeah,
objection?
Any objection? Right. Seeing none, so moved. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 1552.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 1552. Is there any discussion?
Just thank you again, colleagues.
And I do appreciate Senator George bringing this forward to make sure that we are focusing this bill on the truly bad actors and not encompassing small credit unions and small banks who may not be the problem in this big foreclosure mess that we have. Further discussion. All right. Is there any objection to the Dash 2 moving into Senate Bill 1552? Seeing none, so moved. Senator Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 1552.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved the Dash 3 amendment into Senate Bill 1552. Any discussion?
I'm not thanking the AG.
Well, this amendment will allow some rulemaking so that banks who will be engaged in this will have a little more time to prepare. And is there any other discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 1552 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 1552 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just for clarification, Senator George, it has the three amendments in it.
Yeah. Okay.
We just adopted them.
And we
Senator Boquist, you're happy? You're okay with that?
I said I wasn't thanking the AG for the dash three amendment, but I did vote for your amendment.
And we did give you
credit
for targeting this towards the bad actors and not encompassing small credit unions and small banks.
Great, thank you.
We appreciate that amendment. Any further discussion? Could you please call the roll?
Senator Boquist.
Yes.
Senator Dingfelder.
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Vice Chair George.
Aye.
Chair Shields.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. We were thinking that Senator Beyer and Senator Boquist could co-carry this.
Sure. Love to be in the target range.
Senator Boquist and Senator Beyer will be co-carriers. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1552 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1564. Jan.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 1564 was heard by the committee last week. This is the bill that requires a beneficiary to determine if the homeowner qualifies for a foreclosure avoidance measure. And the dash one amendment was offered by Senator George, and it deletes the provision that makes a violation an unlawful practice. There is no revenue impact on the dash one amendment, and there is a minimal fiscal impact. The statement has been issued on the original bill and the dash one amendment.
Thank you, Jan. You want to discuss your amendment, or should we move forward?
Well, Mr. Chair, my concern is that when we're talking about all these different regulations, every time we kick things to the Unfair Trade Practices Act, what we end up with is another layer of regulatory oversight. And if we have a problem with DCBS implementing the regulation, we should do it through DCBS. Not have DCBS regulate, and then also have the Attorney General regulate through the unfair trade practices. So to me, it's duplicative and creates a whole series of problems. So I'd like to see that provision taken out.
Okay. So I'm going to call on Senator Rosenbaum in just a second to make a motion to move the bill to the floor, unless you have something you would like to say.
You want to make a motion to add the dash one?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1564. I just walked in the door. I was late. For goodness sakes.
Thank you. You're welcome. Chair gives every courtesy to the minority in this committee, I'll tell you.
We appreciate that. We're being civilized here.
Senator George has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1564. Is there discussion? I think I would like to say that we've given the banks 5 years to remedy this and to try to move this bill forward without an actual mechanism for a remedy that is offered in this bill, I think would be a mistake. And so I would advocate defeating the dash one amendment because I believe that the Attorney General should be able to go after those banks that engage in fraud in these manners. Further discussion?
Let's vote.
Could we please call the roll on the adoption of the dash one amendment?
Senator Boquist?
Yes, for adoption.
Senator Dingfelder?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
No. The motion fails. The dash one is not adopted. Senator Rosenbaum?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1564 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 1564 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you. I appreciate the fact that some people think that this problem has been dealt with, but I think it's clear from the testimony that we heard from people like Mr. Collette and Ms. Real and so many people at our hearing last week that unfortunately Oregon is still mired in a huge problem with foreclosure. I think this bill offers some simple timelines that should be easy to administer, and it's something that we really need to provide certainty for those Oregonians that are threatened with losing their homes. I think it'll go a long way to restore some stability and just basic common sense, and I think it's great that we're moving the bill this morning.
And for those of you who are perhaps hearing about this bill for the first time, what the bill will do is end the process of dual track in foreclosure, where a bank is telling you that they're working on a modification all the while at the same time working on the foreclosure process. So further discussion? We made the motion to move? Yes, we have.
Yes, she did.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Could you please call the roll?
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
No.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senate Bill 1564 is on its way to the floor.
Mr. Chair?
Senator George?
I'd like to serve notice of a possible minority report.
Senator George has served notice as a possible for a possible minority report, and the carrier for the bill will be, I think we said Senator Bates would carry that bill. So I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1564, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1548. Ms. Chan.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 1548 was heard by the committee last week. This is a bill that prohibits the publication in print or on the internet an advertisement for a job vacancy that would discriminate against the unemployed, and it imposes a civil penalty not to exceed $1,000. There are no amendments before you. There is no revenue impact on the bill. There is a minimal fiscal impact, and the statement has been issued.
All right, so this one is ready to go, and no amendments. So, Senator George, you want to make a motion on Senate Bill 1548?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1548 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 1548 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Just one comment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Buckley.
I would hope as it's implemented, we don't start at the $1,000 mark. We start at a reasonable mark.
Legislative intent, well noted. Further discussion. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Senator Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 1548 is moving to the floor. And Senator Rosenbaum, you want to carry it?
I would love to. Thank you.
Senator Rosenbaum will be the carrier. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1548. And since Senator Winters is here, what I'd like to do is open a public hearing briefly for Senate Bill 1587 so that she can testify and get back to committee. Senator Winters, please.
Thank you, Chair Shields, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Senator Jackie Winters. I represent Senate District 10, and I'm here this morning to testify in support of Senate Bill 1587. Just to give you some historic perspective, the issue surrounding Senate Bill 1587 came to my attention from a constituent of mine in 2009. And it because of then, and which I believe there's still some concern of the board, and this board that had at that time, and I think still does, some issues of conflict of interest. I subsequent to the introduction of Senate Bill, the Senate Bill in 2009, I met with the board, had extensive conversation with the board executive director, as well as the national consultant at that time, which was a member of my community, Fred Bonatta, and the lobbyist for the board, Stephen Cafori. We worked out what I thought was going to be an amicable agreement with the board that they would remove those conflicts of interest. And since then, it's come to my attention that they did partially, but it wasn't totally. And let me describe some of the conflicts that I identified in 2009, which has an adverse effect on its members. You know, we're accustomed to where our boards are professional and members of that board are part of that makeup. But where you have a situation where those members also receive or benefit from a compensation that can have a direct effect on one of its other members, that poses a direct conflict in the activity of the board itself. And that's what occurred with this particular complaint that came to me. In addition, what I have since learned, and that the individual who not only received remuneration as a result, but also was the individual who has the authority or can have the authority to issue complaints, can also carry out those complaints against a number of its members if they so choose. It's interesting to me that where we have a situation of an individual, a member, who can exercise that kind of power over its member, then that board is not functioning to the level of what we as legislators would expect it to. Originally, when I had this discussion with members of my caucus, and I made the recommendation that we remove their semi-independence, I have since had conversation with the governor's office and others, my apology, because I thought that we were going to get an amendment to you today that would address the issue, but as well talk about maybe having them come back to report to this body of what they have done or would do to resolve this particular issue of conflict. I have in my file, and you will hear from my constituent, not only from them, but from others who have also had issues with the board. It's not just my constituent who have had this issue. I believe it's serious enough for this body to receive a report back from this board, how it intends to address the issue of conflict, how it intends to carry out its policies, and its regulatory responsibility. I have a whole list of issues, and I'm sorry that I can't be here to respond to all your questions because I'm presiding over another committee meeting this afternoon. But I will stop now and ask if there's any questions that you may have of me. And I want to thank my good Senator George for giving me the opportunity by signing on to this bill with me.
Quick question, Mr.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Senator Winters, you said there's an amendment in process that would eliminate all boards or would cause a report? You lost me.
No, there's an amendment that would specifically to this particular board, the ACLB, and require them to come back and report to us. And that amendment, as I understand it, went to LC and is waiting for a fiscal impact statement, and why, I don't know, but the amendment did not get filed by our Ledge Council.
Well, question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist, yes.
Senator Winters, I don't remember who I heard it from, but I heard that there was some discussion in the executive branch about potentially unsemi-ing all the boards. I'm not quite sure what it was, but that's why I'm trying to be vague here.
I think the executive branch is probably looking at all boards and commissions right now because, you know, and I did have conversation with them about it in the interim to talk about the authority of boards, mm-hmm. And particularly semi-independent boards. Mm-hmm. the issue surrounding that is a fiscal one, whether or not we want to use general fund dollars in order to provide that oversight, which that would require if we went to a non-semi-independent. Currently, as semi-independent, none of their dollars come from general fund. It's all fee and license generated. And so as the governor's office and I talked about this particular issue, not wanting to impose a general fund fiscal obligation, the substitute was to come up with an amendment that would require reporting back to this body by this particular agency, this particular board. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Dinkfelder.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Winters, for bringing this forward. And I'm, I was looking through the report on the semi-independent boards over the weekend. And one question I have is, my understanding, all these boards are required to go through an audit process and submit those audits to the Secretary of State's office. So the question about has there been an issue with their audit? Do you know, you talked about conflicts, and I'm curious if that's been documented through the audit process.
The I do not believe that it has, and I have not seen their audit of this particular board. The conflict, Senator Dingfelder, that exists is where you have members of a board who can receive compensation based on being that member. This particular board, as appraisers, you can have an appraisal of a property, and for whatever reason, if there is some question, you have what's called the review of the reviewers. And the board can select that person to review the work of the original assessment. In this particular case, it was a member of the board who was selected. That member of the board also has become the individual who has issued a complaint against the other member, and who also would sit in judgment of that member. Who also would be the individual who administers the violation or the punishment, if you will. I do not think, in all my years as the state ombudsman, in looking at fairness, would I say that this is a fair process. And that's what came to my attention. I also, and I will get you copies of, did ask questions through our Ethics Commission because I do think that there are ethical issues here. And I have a report back from them, and they pointed out some of the legislation that we as a body probably will need to get involved with. It's easy for some particular board. I've asked the question about how their process, if one does not agree with the penalty or the outcome of any investigation, and you know, we in this body some 10 years ago put in place what's called the administrative hearing process. It's my understanding, and I will follow up further from an individual, that that particular resolution does not necessarily bind the board. I don't think from our perspective we would anticipate that to be to happen. We would anticipate if the administrative hearing process, whatever that decision is rendered by that administrative law judge, that goes forward unless the individuals want to challenge that through the next hearing process. So I do believe that there is a need to have a report back from the questions that some of the questions that I've raised back to this body.
Well, it seems like you have some very valid concerns, and Senator George?
Yeah, colleagues, Senator Winters brought this idea to me, but it's something that I've been seeing is a big issue on all of these boards, and I appreciate her hard work on this specific one. When I served over on business and transportation, we had to trim back the accountancy board. There was a bill that came forward two sessions in a row to then require licenses at the Board of Landscaping for people who mow lawns. The question I raise is, if you got to have a license to mow lawns, what about my 10-year-old next-door neighbor that wants to mow my lawn? And so the answer from the industry was to create an amendment that exempted people under 18 who mowed less than 10 lawns, which sort of missed the point. The problem is that these boards and commissions, and I remember when this particular board was created, I was a lobbyist in the building, is they become not defenders of the public good, or they're not there to protect the public interest. What they do is they become a way to protect their rent seekers. They basically move to protect themselves from competition, and they become a clique, and they make it hard to enter their field, and they become barriers of entry. And this is one of those boards that back in the 90s, I remember being concerned that this is exactly the kind of thing that would happen. And Senator Winters is basically a policy decision was made in the 1990s to move forward with this under the guise of protecting the public. And in essence, what's happened is that this has been a way to create barriers to entry into the field. And I know it's a term that's being beat up quite a bit lately, but a type of crony capitalism where only certain people can be in on the inside. And I'm afraid that this is not just in this particular board, but in a number of boards. And so one of the reasons I think this is an important discussion is that I think these boards have to be accountable and have to be open to the public. This is a big issue that if you're in a business that is governed by one of these boards that's regulated, you are 100%, your business is dependent on what this board thinks of you. And that's why this is so important that elected officials have a lot of oversight over boards and commissions and their regulatory power. Because otherwise what happens is a small clique can control an entire industry. And that's really wrong. I'm hoping that what we do is the amendments were supposed to come through back to my office. For some reason there was a problem between LC and getting amendments back. But I'm hoping that what we can do is move this bill to Ways and Means and await these amendments, because I think it's really important that Senator Winter's message is sent now in this session so that we can actually deal with the substantive issues when we come back in January. And so I would urge the committee to consider moving this bill on to Ways and Means to keep it alive and hopefully come up with a bill that we can get a report back and see some movement between now and next year. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator George. I really appreciate you bringing this forward, Senator Winters. I think it would be very difficult for us as a policy committee to send this on when we haven't even seen the really what it sounds like to be a gut and stuff of the bill, and then to then allow it to happen down in Ways and Means. I mean, I understand that it does happen here, but the fact that the policy committee hasn't even seen the amendment may make it difficult. But we will have other people coming up to testify on this shortly, and that's where I stand right now.
Mr. Chair, and I can appreciate it. You will hear from my constituent, and there are others that are here, and I hope you give some thoughtful thought to this, because it's not really just it's an amendment to the original bill. It just takes out the issue of the termination and in place in it the responsibility, the requirement to report back to this body. And I hope you really think about that, because it's serious. It's serious when you begin to think in terms of it would be something if we had said if it was fixed in 2009 and I thought that fix that I thought was going to take place, and we're talking 2012. And I'm still dealing with this particular issue. Granted, and the one testimony you will hear is that the individual that was the original conflict was removed from the board. And then just recently, the governor's office would not reappoint the other member. But the fact that it exists within the body becomes problematic. And I do think that it's that this body, as legislators, that just to create an entity and not to have a process for oversight is derelict on our part. So I appeal to you to think in terms of the senator's solution, and I apologize that whatever happened in our rapidness in this building right now to get things through the process that you did not receive the amendment.
No, and I can appreciate that. I do guarantee you that we will have the committee or have the agency come back and report to us during the interim on advances that they would make in this regard. Senator Boquist.
Yeah, just three quick points for the record. Senator Winter is right on the administrative judge things. We dealt with this in judiciary last session. I think it was last session, whenever I was in judiciary. And you remember the old argument came up that the agency can accept or reject what the administrative judge is, so that they are God in some respects. So that issue she doesn't have to go back on. That's known. The second point is if I could figure out an amendment to this, I would put one in to get rid of the landscapers board because I think they hoodwinked us last time around. And the third option is that you could always go to rules, which is a policy committee.
That's true.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you. Just a comment about, and Senator Winters, I think you raised some really good points. You know, part of my understanding is we already do have a lot of opportunities for oversight. I'm going to say that not always happens. I mean, what my understanding is that these semi-independent agencies, they do have to do audits. They do have to submit it to the Secretary of State. They do have to submit it to the Governor, the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, and Legislative Fiscal. And reading of this report, LFO is supposed to review all of these reports and prepare a joint statement of findings and submit this with their conclusions to the legislature. Now, I don't serve on the Audits Committee anymore, but I did used to, and we would hear on a regular basis. That is, I think, the best opportunity for oversight. So I'm not disagreeing that we probably don't have enough oversight, because I think given the limited resources that this body has and the fact that we do not have policy staff beyond the staffing of our committees, I do think that we certainly could have more tools for better oversight. So I'm not convinced that actually more legislation is needed or just more resources to do that oversight, which I think is a constant challenge for us. But certainly, you know, I'd be happy to look at the amendment.
All right. Yeah. And I know you have to get to committee. I think we are going to stick on this bill because we're waiting on another amendment or paperwork on another bill. So, Senator Winters, any closing comments?
Just that I hope you give this serious, serious consideration. If it wasn't affecting someone's livelihood, if it wasn't where we grant certain authority and powers to individuals and never go back and revisit it, I want you to think about that, because if I am a member of an organization and that organization has the ability to say yay or nay, whether I am licensed or unlicensed, the audit does not pick up those kinds of issues. Those usually come to us because something has happened, and most people do not come before this body where they are complaining because they're afraid. I mean, let's be very honest about who holds the power and control. And it just happened that I had, you know, some individuals in my community who thought it was wrong. You know, and because they thought it was wrong, I believe that there's been some retaliation as a result of it. I said it started in 2009. It's still continuing in 2012. And it's only until I brought this back again did we get to the issue with that, and working with the governor's office, that the individual was not reappointed. You know, to me, it's not just talking about the audit picks up whether or not your fiduciary responsibility and those kinds of issues. I think as a body, I brought this forward, and it would be, if it was just one, I would say that's one thing. If it was more than one, then that's two. And I would also, I know that there's some information that you should receive from even the tactical approaches that's being used by the investigator of this particular organization, asking questions of the person's staff as to vacations and how long they've taken those vacations. I don't know that any place in any of our public policy do we ask a private entity when and how long they should take a vacation. So I do hope that you really give serious thought to this. It, to me, it is very serious. And maybe I go back to my old days of being the ombudsman. Thank you very much, Mr.
Appreciate
Chair.
Appreciate it. Could we please bring up Dan Forsberg, Lori Egan, and Frank George. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chairman, Senator Shields, Vice Chair Senator George, and members of the committee. My name is Diane Forsberg. I've been in the appraisal business for 14 years and currently a state certified residential appraiser. I currently serve on the board of the Portland chapter of the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers and past president of the Oregon Appraisers Coalition. I'm here today representing myself and the Rose City chapter, and we stand in opposition of SB 1857 and in unison with our local chapter of the Appraisal Institute and the local chapter of the Oregon Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers. You'll forgive me if I read most of this. There's lots of facts here I do not want to misstate. This bill would strip the Oregon Appraiser Certification Licensor Board, known as the ACLB, and the only agency of 11 noted in this bill, of its semi-independent status and its autonomy to control over its own budget. Today, I would like to direct your attention to three specific points regarding the ACLB, and that's efficiency, cost-effectiveness, and compliance. Efficiency is really the sum of all three of these and discussed here and throughout my testimony. Semi-independent boards are able to save time and money and offer better customer service through their quicker response times. As an appraiser, I started my career before 2001 when the board achieved its semi-independent status. At that time, it was challenging at best to communicate with the board or get consistent information, even if at all. After 2001, there was a noticeable change in quicker communication and accurate information from the ACLB, and it has been consistent ever since. Second, cost effectiveness. The semi-independent agencies have a shortened budget cycle and are allowed to actively and efficiently perform with relevance to their specific duties and tasks. These agencies have little charges. Our agency, actually the ACLB, has very few charges that relate to DAS. They have the ability to comparison shop for supplies and services, and the total budget process takes about 2 to 3 months, as opposed to 18 months required of most state agencies, and this bill would require that of our agency. And are self-funded, not relying on general fund or emergency board bailouts. I think it's very important in this time of government constraints and budget cuts. A fiscal impact statement was made available titled Fiscal Impact of Proposed Legislation. When you read that, you discovered that if this bill passes, the state government service charge would be an additional $30,000. Shared client services would add another $40,815. That's another over $70,000 for services already provided by the board. We wonder where that money's going to come from. Third, compliance. This board has a biennial board report. It already goes to the governor, the state's, the Senate's president, the Speaker of the House, and the Legislative Fiscal Office. Budgets are set by rulemaking via the public hearing process with notice to all licensed and interested parties. The ACLB achieved semi-independence in 2001 and is routinely audited by the appraisal subcommittee that is a federal agency that monitors the requirements for the certification and licensing of appraisers and conducts audits of all state boards. In 1997, the appraisal subcommittee performed an audit of the ACLB and found, and I quote, "The board has a large number of open complaints dating from 1993, 1994, and 1995, which require expeditious resolution." In 2000, there was another audit from the appraisal subcommittee, and they stated, "Our review revealed there were weaknesses in the Oregon complaint investigation and resolution program. We have repeatedly expressed concerns regarding these shortcomings during past interviews. Unless significant improvements are made in the program, we will be forced to address the matter with the governor of Oregon." Further, complaint cases had been backlogged consistently, an average of 2 and frequently up to 4 years. We sent a copy of our April 14, 1997 review letter to the Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, where the ACLB was located at that time, urging increased staffing and streamlining of systems to reduce the backlog. Our current review reveals that there has been little, if any, improvement in keeping the complaint backlog from increasing. In the year 2000, the ACLB had 221 open case files. In 2001, it achieved semi-independence, and in 2003, the appraisal subcommittee audit stated your program functions effectively and in a manner consistent with Title 11, which is the Financial Institution Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act of 1989. We are pleased that the board has maintained its efforts to investigate and resolve complaints efficiently. And verbally, in the board meeting of that same year, as of August 1st, 2000, the ACLB has 221 open complaint files. Since that time, the ACLB has received 168 new complaints for a total of 389 cases. The ACLB has closed 331 of those cases since that time. The total number of unresolved cases since August 2000 has been reduced to 58 open cases. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a reduction of 85%.
Ms. Forsberg, could you summarize the rest of your testimony so that we can get through and make sure everybody else has a chance to...
I just have a little bit more.
Yeah.
Okay. Subsequent audits by the appraisal subcommittee are good. They are always in substantial compliance with Title 11. What I'm getting at is from the time that they achieved semi-independent status, the ACLB has been consistent, and the facts support efficiency, cost-effectiveness, and compliance. And here we are again. So on behalf of myself and the Rose City Chapter, we strongly urge you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Egan.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, I will be very brief. My name is Lori Egan. I live in Oregon City, and I've been an appraiser in the Portland metro area for 25 years. During that time, I've owned an appraisal firm, an appraisal management company, and currently work in the collateral risk division of a national bank. I appear today as an executive officer of the National Association of Appraisers, and we urge you not to move this bill out of committee. During the past 2 years, I've had the pleasure to speak on the topics of appraisal independence and regulation of appraisal management companies at a number of national conferences across the country. From this perspective, I've had the opportunity to witness firsthand what others outside of Oregon think about the Oregon Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. The Oregon Board is recognized by many as a model program, and many agencies have emulated Oregon, particularly in the area of complaint investigation and enforcement. My observations are supported by the audit findings of the Appraisal Subcommittee, which is the federal agency charged with oversight over appraisal boards. The National Association of Appraisers opposes this bill because we value a strong and fair regulatory program, and we also believe Oregon's semi-independent model is the primary reason for its success. This is based on clear evidence of the board's performance before and after they were granted semi-independent status, as Diane has already discussed. We strongly urge you to not terminate the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board's semi-independent status. Thank you.
Mr. George.
Senator Shields, Chair Shields, and members of the committee. As you know, Senate Bill 1587 singles out one board of all the semi-independently operated boards. It does not propose to make any other changes. It is a gut and stuff. It appears to be a gut and stuff amendment. However, doing so could undermine...
Excuse me. Could you state your name for the record?
I apologize. Just get on tape. My name is Frank George. I've been an appraiser in Oregon for 10 years. Clackamas County resident. Sorry. Doing so, as I was saying, would reduce the board's ability to carry out a very important, very essential exercise that's mandated by the appraisal subcommittee, the Title 11 of the Financial Institution Reform and Recovery Act. Okay? The appraisal subcommittee has had many things to say about the appraisal board, basically in two different time periods, before it existed as a semi-independent agency and after it existed as a semi-independent agency. As the records will show, consistently, on a consistent basis, and has been testified here earlier, the board did not have the means, the resources, the administrative capability to perform the functions that were required by the federal government. This creates a serious risk to the lending institutions and programs in the state of Oregon. If that appraisal subcommittee de-recognizes the appraisal certifications and licenses of appraisers in the state, they won't back the loans, or, you know, it affects the ability to get loans. So they urged the legislature, they urged the Department of Consumer Services to take measures to reduce the very extensive process that was in place at the time, from 1997 to 2000. That there was an incredible number of backlogs dating back to 4 or 5 years in the processing of appraisal enforcement cases, which are a matter of public trust, and not enough action was being taken. As a result, the board granted semi-independent status. Since that time, the reviews that happen biannually from the appraisal subcommittee have been glowing, to say the least. The appraisal board has performed every function that is mandated that it perform, not only by the people of the state, or expected by the people of the state of Oregon, the Oregon legislature, but also Title 11 of FIREA. They've used exemplary comments. The board is recognized throughout the nation as a role model for other boards and other states that are dealing with significant issues in enforcement that instill the public trust in the process. The board has not demonstrated bias. It's met every one of its reviews, every one of its audits. It's been found to be fair in its application. And the matrix that it utilizes in disciplinary actions has been exemplary and has been noted by the appraisal subcommittee in their review process. So I'd like to urge you to not move the bill forward out of this committee, because I think that it singles out one board, which is doesn't appear to be very uniform in application, and it would greatly limit this board's ability to perform this business service for the people of Oregon.
Thank you very much for coming down to testify. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Could we please bring up Robert Green, Wayne Richard, and Al Wakefield.
I guess I'm in the middle. I'll go first. You can hear me okay?
Yes.
Good morning, Senator Shields, Vice Chair George, and the members of the committee. My name is Robert M. Green. I'm addressing the committee both as a certified real estate appraiser in the state of Oregon and as the 2012 president of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute. You should know the Appraisal Institute is the preeminent professional organization for real estate appraisers in the United States. It has nearly 24,000 members. It is the largest body of real estate appraisers in the country. And it is truly a professional organization, and that is, it is concerned with the standards, the standards, the reliability, the professionalism, and independence of the real estate valuation profession. We are not a trade organization. We are interested, of course, in our own welfare, but beyond that, we have committed ourselves to the highest standards of excellence and public service. It is an article of faith for us that we are best served when the greater good of the public is served. The Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute has 377 members, in addition to other members residing in Washington but licensed as well in Oregon. It's the largest such group in our state, and its goals mirror the larger goals of the Appraisal Institute in general. I have been asked by the officers, the members of the Board of Directors, and the members of the chapter to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 1587. I fully agree with the chapter's opposition to this bill, and there are three primary reasons. The current semi-independent board, AACLB, has been recognized by the National Appraisal Subcommittee as a model for good governance and supervision of the uniform standards for professional appraisal practice. There are a lot of acronyms and bureaucratic slang and so forth, but the Appraisal Subcommittee is a national body that arises out of the federal lending requirements, and it supervises and creates directly and indirectly standards for a real estate appraisal. The Appraisal Subcommittee is the overarching national committee, and its mission is to maintain the integrity of valuation standards for federally related transactions, including mortgages by federally chartered lending institutions. It is relevant to note here that the current status of the board arose partially out of a negative report by the Appraisal Subcommittee in 2001, in which the ACLB, in its prior not semi-independent status, could not keep up with enforcement. If that had not been successfully addressed, which included creation of the current semi-independent status, federal lending in the state of Oregon would have been jeopardized. Secondly, real estate valuation is a complex profession that has implications for virtually all citizens in the state of Oregon, for those who invest in real estate, either as lenders or as owners, for homeowners, for taxpayers, and for assessing bodies such as the counties and the Oregon Department of Revenue. The public will be better served by a semi-independent body that has the experience, the specialized knowledge, and the dedication to master the field. Moreover, this particular moment, when real estate has been buffeted by a host of fundamental economic and financial forces, is a poor time to jeopardize a well-regarded regulatory body. And finally, the majority of our members are in favor of the current semi-independent status. I do not believe everyone is entirely happy with everything about the ACLB, but there are no complaints of which I am aware that cannot be addressed under the current status, and I am sure that they will be. A proposed change will make the regulatory process less responsive, not more. I stress that I and our organization speak out of concern for the standards of our profession and the greater public good. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Who would like to go next?
Good morning, Chairman Shields, members of the committee. My name is Wayne Richards. I am a state-certified general appraiser in Oregon, a member of the Appraisal Institute, and chair of the Government Relations Committee for the Appraisal Institute. I have been an appraiser for over 40 years. I was here when the ACLB was created, and I have been involved with the ACLB in various capacities over 20 years. I was there when the first administrators failed to perform their responsibilities in compliance with the federal mandates. Disciplinary actions became severely delinquent, and the feds were threatening to decertify the board and stop lending in the state of Oregon. It was at this time a decision was made to charter a new course for the ACLB as a semi-independent board. A new administrator was brought in. That was Bob Keith. He was hired to correct the problems of the prior administrators and bring the ACLB into compliance with the federal regulations promulgated by the appraisal subcommittee. It took a number of years to correct the problems and bring the ACLB into compliance. The appraisal subcommittee audits since 2006 have been highly positive to the board and Bob Keith. I refer you to the audit summaries that Bob Keith probably has submitted to the to your committee. I am told also that the Oregon board is looked at as a model for other states to emulate. With regard to Senate Bill 1587, I have considered in what I perceive to be the merits of this bill, and I find there are none. I have concluded there is no political advantage to be gained by terminating the ACLB's semi-independent status. All that would be gained is possibly a change in leadership, and why would we want to settle for second best? The appraisal subcommittee has stated that Bob Keith is a highly respected and effective administrator, and that we are fortunate to have him. I have concluded there's no financial advantage to be gained by terminating the ACLB's semi-independent status. The ACLB is a self-funding agency and operates within its budget. Removal of the board's semi-independent status effectively places control of the board's budgets and fees in the hands of three government agencies, thus significantly increasing the board's costs of operation. And in fact, the financial impact will fall upon the backs of the appraisers, and to what end? We need to be reminded that most appraisers licensed in Oregon are residential appraisers struggling to make a living in difficult times. There is this is more problematic today, as residential appraisers have had to surrender up to half of their customary appraisal fees to appraisal management companies and other costs. Rising costs, government fees, and overregulation have driven many good appraisers out of the profession. I ask you, what emergency exists that demands such drastic action? How will the public peace, health, and safety be better served with the passage of Senate Bill 1587? I cannot see. The ACLB is not perfect. I have seen how it operates, and I've heard a number of stories concerning disciplinary actions that are unsettling. I am also the recipient of an appraisal board disciplinary action. If these stories that I've heard are true, some changes might be in order. It has been 20 years since the board was created, and not a lot of changes have been made. Senate Bill 1587 is not a fix, but a step back into the dark ages. It punishes 1,500 licensees, your constituents, in the process with no material benefit toward the public good. What I would recommend is an independent panel to review board actions and disciplinary processes and make recommendations for change if needed. I have heard from Bob Keith some encouraging ideas in this regard and need to be further explored. Chairman Shields, Vice Chairman Green, and members of the committee, I and my fellow members of the Appraisers Institute, whom I represent, along with my associate here, strongly urge you to vote against the passage of Senate Bill 1587. It's just simply wrong.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Al Wakefield, and good morning, committee members. I am not like these other gentlemen. I'm just a lay appraiser. I'm a certified general appraiser in the state of Oregon, a member of the Appraisal Institute of America, and a member of the Oregon Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers. One thing I would like to dispute or make correct in Ms. Senator Winter's comment was the fact that the board is not a clique. The board is voted on by the members of the appraisers in the state. We elect our people. And I just want to say that I'm against this. I know where this came from. I know the back roads that this came through to get to your committee, and it's disgusting that it's even here. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, gentlemen. I don't have seen no one else ready to sign up to testify against this. I do. I would like to discuss what the proposed amendment would do, and I think that Senator Winters would like to have her concerns addressed by the board over the interim, and I would agree with that. We would like to see the board come back and look at the substance of the amendment, which was really just a reporting back process. And Senator George has the draft amendment request. I would like the board to meet with Senator George and address three topics as we head into the interim: how the board deals with dispute resolution, how the board deals with conflict of interest, and what the current process is to become an appraiser. And Senator George has a document that will give you more information. I think oversight is the proper role for this committee, and so while we won't be moving this amendment forward, we will like to stay abreast of the topic. Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I have a question of staff, because considering that in the semi-independent board and agency model of efficiency of state agencies report, which I think we all have, it's an interesting read, but I guess my question to staff is, it doesn't look like the typical report we get, because it doesn't say who it came from or what agency produced it or anything. Could we track down, is this a self-evaluation from these boards? Is this from the Secretary of State? Is it, I mean, like some authenticity to it, or authorship, I guess, if you could, please, if you'd indulge me, Mr. Chair, at some future point. Thanks.
Absolutely.
Can I just add, Senator, that this was a report that was provided by the administrator of the ACLB, Bob Keith. He provided it with his written testimony.
Well, okay, it says it's a report on the efficiency of all agencies, so I'm assuming there must be an endorsement or a signature sheet like typical state law from all these boards and agencies. I'm trying to figure out who did the report and where it came from. Thanks.
I'll invite you on that.
All right, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1587 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1518. We were waiting for the paperwork on the dash twos. We haven't received that, so I think
we did while we were having this hearing.
Great. All right, and so why don't I let you tee it up for us, Jan, and tell us where we are.
Hello, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 1518 was heard by the committee last week, and this is the bill that addresses some public contracting issues. And the committee last week adopted the dash one amendment, and since then, Senator Rosenbaum's staff has brought forward a dash two amendment, and that would include everything that was in the dash one, as well as deleting a requirement that DAS report on special procurements for construction contracts. Also, very, very technical, deletes a first-tier reference when describing subcontractors in the personnel deployment provision, and it deletes Department of Transportation from provision relating to the rulemaking on those personnel deployment provisions. And so if the committee were wishing to go forward with the dash two, you would suspend the rules for vote reconsideration on the dash one amendment.
Okay.
Can you tell me in English what she just said?
So
yeah, sure, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it would be good to have.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, the dash twos, I'll make a motion in a minute, but the dash twos came about because of some testimony that Associated General Contractors provided about a couple of technical changes that they thought needed to be made. And so we incorporated those along with all the provisions of the dash one that we had already adopted. So that's basically what the dash twos do. And
I'm assuming, because this kind of come from a work group where people working together, everybody's kind of on board.
Senator Rosenbaum. Senator Boquist, as far as I know, nobody opposes this, and it's generally supported. And
Appreciate the clarification.
Thanks.
Senator George. I want to ask Senator Rosenbaum a question. So as the way I read it now, basically what it is a transparency. By the time we get to the dash two amendments, it's basically a transparency bill.
Absolutely, Senator George. It's meant to insert some oversight of contracting procedures, provide some information, and then it does still contain that prohibition with exceptions on developing a contract and then turning around and going out and getting the contract. So.
Okay. And so then we're going to need two motions, one to remove the dash one and then and then for the dash two. So.
So we have to remove the dash one and then. Okay.
Are you comfortable with that?
Sure.
Yeah. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move that the. We have to reopen the.
Work session?
No. We have to say that we have to vote to reconsider it, and then we have to take it out. Okay. I move that we suspend the rules and reconsider the amendment, dash one amendments adopted by this committee earlier.
Senator George moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1518. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the motion to suspend the rules carries.
Mr. Chair, I move that we withdraw the dash one amendments from Senate Bill 1518.
Senator George moves to reconsider the vote in which the committee adopted the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1518. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Adopt the dash twos.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1518.
Senator George has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1518. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Senator George?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1518 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 1518
as amended.
To the floor with as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, we know what we're doing.
will the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Senator Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 1518 is on its way to the floor. Did you have a carrier in mind, Senator Rosenbaum?
I would be happy to carry it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosenbaum will be the carrier, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1518. And I will I just got word that a person wanted to testify on Senate Bill 1587, but inadvertently signed up for the wrong bill. So just briefly, I will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1587, and Kathy Goss, please come forward.
I greatly appreciate that. I'm not used to your process, and I was sitting there wondering what I'd done wrong. My apologies to all of you. But I will make it quick. I know you're in a hurry, and so I will get right to it. Chairman Shields is not here. I thank him. I thank the other members of the committee. My name is Kathy Goss, and I reside at 3422 El Dorado Loop South. I'm here to support the amendments for 1587, Senate Bill 1587, as amended. And I have looked at amendments and read them, and I believe it's a reasonable way to go. I believe the amendments will help develop legislative proposals to facilitate transparency and fairness for appraisers throughout this state. I am a certified general appraiser for the state of Oregon. I fall under the jurisdiction of the ACLB of the state of Oregon. My husband and I own Capital Valuation Group. We have been in business 15 years and complete an average of 200 commercial appraisals annually. We have never had a complaint filed against us that resulted in a fine or penalty. We have trained many of Salem's best appraisers who have gone on to establish their own offices. Unfortunately, my firm has been involved in an administrative complaint since June of 2011. The complaint concerns a very complicated appraisal that we wrote in 2008, nearly 4 years ago. The complaint came directly from the ACLB, not from the client or the property owner. The ACLB investigator contacted two assistant appraisers who had been employed in my office. Both were interviewed, all before I was asked a single question. One assistant was called on the phone by the ACLB investigator asking if she could chat, if he could chat with her at a local restaurant, and assured her he would not record the interview. She did not know him and refused to go. He stated she must cooperate or she would risk being sanctioned by the ACLB. She finally said she would meet him only at the ACLB office. He did not record that interview, but she was in tears at the conclusion. She was asked about her brother, who used to work for us, about our vacations, when, how long, and how many, how she was supervised, and by whom. I believe this interrogation was abusive, punitive, and far afield. She had nothing to do with the report involved in the complaint. I have printed materials of what occurred during that interview. The entire process has caused fear and distrust in my office. After this experience, I felt compelled to engage an attorney to be present during all interviews to prevent this inappropriate behavior by the staff. The ACLB functions as complainant, investigator, prosecutor, judge, and jailer. They have full and complete ability to close the doors of our business and take away our licenses, as well as the income stream and the insurance benefits that I pay to my employees and their families. I have yet to be asked to discuss the complaint with their board. I have not yet been provided an investigative report, only the verbal warning that further interviews will most likely be necessary. This lengthy investigation has only provided anxiety to my clients and to my employees. Because of limited time, I'm skipping some of the complications in my case, but the governor has interceded and resolved some conflicts of interest on the board. Again, I think this amended bill will be helpful to the future operation of the ACLB, and I ask, please, if you would forward that bill. Thank you, and thank you one time more for accepting my error and allowing me to speak. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, colleagues. And it has come to my attention that this bill has other dimensions to it going on in the building that I may have been unaware of. So it looks like this bill will likely live another day. So I think at this point, if we were to move this to Ways and Means, will we need all five? Without the paperwork, or just
you have the fiscal and revenue on the bill, so you can move
on the
it
bill without the amendment.
Okay. That, right, we have no amendment.
Okay. All right, and so
do you want me to
George,
make a motion?
Oh yeah. What? I'll close the public hearing.
Senator Rosenbaum has a question.
Oh, Senator
I'm sorry,
Rosenbaum.
Did you? Are you recognizing me for a motion?
I could. Well, I close the public hearing, and I need to open the work session. Correct.
Yes. Yes. Are you just moving the bill unamended to
Ways and Means?
To Ways and Means. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I will open a work session on the bill. Senator Rosenbaum?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1587 to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation as to passage.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 1587 to Ways and Means without recommendation. Could the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Popewicz.
Yes, I'm here. Vote yes. I don't see anybody red face, so I must have voted right.
Senator Dinkfelder.
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Vice Chair George.
Aye.
Chair Shields.
Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 1587 is on its way to Ways and Means without recommendation. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1587, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1502. Jen, could you tee it up for us, please?
Oh, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 1502 reduces the number of members on the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board from 11 members to 8, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Yes.
There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact to the bill. There's a minimal fiscal impact, and the statement has been issued. We had testimony submitted by Joshua Slocum in opposition to the bill.
All right. Opposition. You have the list. All right, let's bring up John Brenneman, Wally Ordeman, and Dwight Terry.
Good Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman. I've represented the Oregon Funeral Directors since 1992, and it was in my first session, Weatherman 93, that we first broached the subject of reducing the size of the ward. It is a large ward at 11 people. For one reason or the other, it hasn't been able to move forward. In the past, the board and staff have opposed that concept, but we don't have the opposition there now. This bill is really pretty simple. What it does is reduce the membership of the board from 11 to 8. People question why an even number, but in order to get people to back away from opposing the bill, they wanted three public members rather than what we proposed, two. We proposed a member of five licensees and two public members, and what we have here is really a compromise. Anybody that's licensed by the board qualifies for membership as a board member. Currently, there are some that are licensed now, but there isn't a designated spot for them. There have been times when some of the positions have been hard to fill. We think this makes a pretty simple issue of it, and along with a previous charge of the governor to make a balance, the only further balance besides geographic and ethnic issues is to make sure there's a balance of licensees that are appointed. There'll be a gradual changeover, and it could be soon. There are some positions that are coming open, and it's a gradual change where if somebody's term expires, they just won't be reappointed, and you don't kick anybody off to get to the eight people. And we think it's, although the cost savings aren't much, it does produce some efficiency and cost savings. We think it makes good sense. And from here,
if you don't have any questions, I'll go to Wally Orderman, who's legislative chair for FDA.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Orderman, and I'm a fifth-generation funeral director from Albany and the legislative chair for the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. The OFDA welcomes the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 1502, and our position on this legislation is very straightforward. The funeral directors in this state understand and welcome regulatory oversight of our industry. Maintaining the highest standards of funeral practice in your communities is our common goal. This legislation provides for a more efficient number of board members while maintaining the proper percentage of public input. But most importantly, it provides the governor with more flexibility in appointing industry members to the board. No more trying to find the exact right person in the exact industry classification on the board. The governor would still have the ability and the obligation to maintain diversification on the board, and Oregon's consumers would also be well represented with three seats on this board. For those who feel the funeral directors in this state have an ulterior motive for supporting 1502, we don't. There's no power play here. The mortuary and cemetery board seats are not elected positions, nor are they appointed by the funeral directors or cemeterians in this state. That's the governor's job. If board efficiency and protection of Oregon's consumers are the goals of this regulatory oversight, then I believe that the citizens of Oregon would be well served through the passage of this bill. I thank you again for your consideration of our testimony, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Terry, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Dwight Terry. I'm the owner of Terry Family Funeral Home and also the manager. It's a family-run funeral home in Portland, Oregon, as well as I'm a part-time funeral service instructor at Mount Hood Community College and vice president of Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I'm here to provide background information on the impacts of SB 1502 and have provided a handout that further quantifies the specific impacts. The board has not taken a formal position for or against this bill, but we had requested and formally supported a similar bill that had been introduced in the 2011 session. The current statutory language does not allow all licensees types the opportunity to serve as board members. This was highlighted during the 2009 session when new licensee types were added. The board was directed in several legislative hearings at that time to fix the imbalance in an upcoming session. The bill addresses this imbalance, creating equal opportunity for all licensees to serve on the board. At this current statute was written, the death care industry was much more fractured than it is today. At the time, it were clear distinctions between funeral establishments, cemeteries, crematories, or other alternative disposition methods. Today, it is common for a single entity to operate a funeral establishment, crematory, and cemetery on or near the same location. Any given individual may hold several different license types and also represent several different facility types. As you can see on the chart in the handout, even our current board members represent a broader segment of the industry, death care industry, than their specific board appointments currently indicate. There are several ways to approach updating the statute and membership criteria, but SB 1502 at least meets our need to be inclusive and balanced as possible, presuming the governor's office uses the appointment balance to balance the overall composition of the board. In theory, we should be able to maintain broader representation, diversity of license type, as well as ethnic and geographical diversity, which is critical in order for our agency to serve the needs of communities and individuals with a broad range of preference of death care services. And that ends my statement. If you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Terry. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Could we please bring up Elizabeth Redigan, Nancy Ward, and Sandra Bishop. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Good morning, Senators. My name is Elizabeth Radigan. I'm speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 1502. I'm here as a private citizen, a constituent of Senator Shields, and the widow of a veteran. 8 years ago today, my husband and I were preparing for his life-saving surgery. And 5 weeks later, he died of brain cancer. During that time, I made a lot of decisions because I was my husband's medical representative, his home hospice caregiver, and the one who planned his funeral. Quite frankly, making decisions concerning his final arrangements were the most difficult because I was alone, uninformed, and grief-stricken. I knew I wasn't in any condition to be making any major financial decisions, and if I was in need of any other product or service, I would have postponed my decision. I learned, though, that final arrangements aren't decisions you can't postpone. At least not for very long. God knows I tried. But that's why consumer protection for funeral services is so paramount. And it's why I'm looking for an oversight commission for this industry that is fair, impartial, balanced, and dedicated to its responsibility to the consumers. And I want to see strong representation by consumers or consumer interest groups. I oppose changes to the OMC board that reduce the number of public representatives. The industry wants to reduce the number of their representatives. Fine. I don't want to see a reduction in the number of public representatives, however. I'm also very uncomfortable leaving the composition of the industry membership so poorly defined that to me it invites abuse or perhaps crony capitalism. I learned a new word today. I don't see any merit to consumers in Senate Bill 1502. And the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Oregon, which represents 12,000 Oregon consumers, stands with me on this matter. I've delivered their written statement to you as well as my own. We are opposed to Senate Bill 1502, senators, and would urge you to stop this bill in committee today. Thank you so very much for your time and attention.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Ward. In 2009, I became involved with the OMCB because of Senate Bill 796, as it pertained to licensing people like me in Oregon who are home funeral guides and educators. We are a group of about 24 women in the state who educate and assist families to act as their own funeral service provider. Between February 2009, when I first learned of SB 796, and June, when the bill was passed, I attended hearings in both the Senate and the House. In January 2010, I was invited by the OMCB to participate in an advisory committee for the purpose of crafting language pertaining to the new license described as a death care consultant. The advisory group met between January and April of 2010. In my contact over a period of approximately 7 months, I was never able to discern where the Funeral Directors Association left off and the OMCB began. Every contact I had with staff at the OMCB included, at a minimum, the executive director of the Funeral Directors Association. Whether or not that is appropriate is not for me to judge. However, from my perspective, it was inhibiting. I had no confidence that the OMCB was acting independent from the trade association. I do not see how the proposed change in the composition of the OMCB will be an improvement for the citizens of Oregon. It appears to be an opportunity to further limit opinion and curtail oversight of a board already heavily under the influence of the people it is intended to regulate. Thank you very much, and I do hope you'll consider voting no on SB 1502.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Bishop.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to address the committee this morning. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop. I'm here today to speak in opposition to the changes requested to the makeup of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board in Senate Bill 1502. I'm representing NOEL, Natural Options at the End of Life. NOEL is a trade association made up of businesses and individuals working with families and friends after someone has died, including consultants, educators, and others such as home funeral planners, and consultants working on design, redesign, and operation of cemeteries to offer environmentally responsible green burials. Many NOEL associates offer alternatives to the services conventionally offered by the funeral industry. We're here today to ask you to please stop Senate Bill 1502. It is an overreaching, apparently an attempt by one segment of the funeral industry, the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, to potentially gain advantage by controlling more seats on this regulatory board. If this bill passes, there will be no guarantee of representation from different segments of the industry on the board. The current designation for members on the Mortuary and Cemetery Board has been very carefully worked out over the years to provide
invaluable insight from a variety of providers and licensees. One of the grave dangers with this bill is the risk that under provisions of Senate Bill 1502, there is no guarantee of cemetery representatives being on the board. There are thousands of cemeteries in Oregon. There are approximately 1,100 historic cemeteries in addition to the cemeteries that are licensed by the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. There are 40 cemeteries in the state, I believe. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact number, but there's somewhere between 30 and 50 cemeteries that hold endowment funds. These endowment care cemeteries hold millions of dollars in trust and in endowment. This is a liability and a risk for the state and also for local municipalities. In Portland alone, there are at least a dozen cemeteries, or a dozen or so, that have what I call been orphaned. Municipalities usually don't set out to own and operate cemeteries. What usually happens is that once a cemetery is abandoned, usually due to bankruptcy, the local city or county ends up taking over the operations. This is the most common way that a cemetery in modern days becomes public. In our society, we do not abandon burial grounds. So you can see there are numerous problems, risks, and unintended consequences with this bill. There is simply not time in this short session to explore those areas of concern and risk. It makes no sense at this point to take away the designations for specific positions on the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. As for cost savings, the risk of inadequate representation far outweighs any potential gain in revenue from cutting expenses from perhaps three board positions. Also, if I'm not mistaken, the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board is fee-driven, and any savings would not result in general fund gains. Legislative history, there's been a little bit of talk about that. These suggested changes have not been publicly discussed recently. The only legislative history is that of promises made to those businesses offering alternatives to the traditional mortuary funeral home process for disposition of a body after someone dies. The promises made during the 2009 session that there were promises made during the 2009 session that there would be that any new licensees would indeed have designated representation on the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. That is a moot point. The new licensee designation that was put together in the 2009 session, we don't believe has really, well, I shouldn't say there aren't any members, but it's not a licensee that category that's necessarily needed to be represented on the board right now. So why would the legislature be considering potentially restricting the representational membership is the real question to ask. So we hope that you oppose Senate Bill 1502. The disposition and handling of a human body after death is a sacred trust. Please do not take a rushed approach to changes in the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Thank you.
Question, Sandra. This bill seems to be the same one as from 2011. Were you representing that organization, and did you express those concerns to the proponents of the bill then?
I was representing the same concerns. We did not think that the bill was going anywhere last session, so we did not step forward to oppose the bill last session.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Boquist.
I have a question for anyone of the ladies. We served earlier testimony that virtually 70% of all individuals are cremated today, and several of you have expressed concern about the actions of the existing board. So how do we get it balanced, and how do we hold the board accountable then? I mean, you've raised issues and problems, and if 70% are cremated now, and that's the vast majority, that represents, it's disbalanced right now. I guess we're looking for a fix is what I'm looking for. I mean, status quo, none of you want really the status quo, but what is it? What would fix this?
Well, in my opinion, the status quo is a better fix, or it isn't a fix. It's better than what is being proposed right now, because there's no designation. And that is where I feel it's very problematic. What will happen to those five positions? Is anyone guaranteed that it will be represented by anything other than the Funeral Directors Association? I mean, I would assume that they will find other people, but there's no guarantee because it's not designated. It's not required.
Well, I think this is going to take a little more work, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1502 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1521. Jan, could you tee it up for us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 1521 creates a five-member board of commercial interior design. It allows the board to hire an executive director. It requires a person practicing commercial interior design to register with the board by January 2013. It establishes the qualifications of a registered interior designer and allows the board to impose a civil penalty for violation. It establishes a board of commercial interior design fund and allows the board to set fees. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments. There is no revenue impact. I think we are waiting to hear about a fiscal impact. The committee has received a number of written testimony that we will submit for the record. Those are opposed. These are in favor. We will submit those for the public record. That is all.
Thank you, Jen. And so, colleagues, we have floor session at 10:30. There are a lot of people signed up to testify. We'll do our best to get through with. Stick with me as long as you can. I think it's unlikely we're going to be moving this bill today, but if you can be here to hear the testimony of the people that obviously care passionately about this topic, I sure would appreciate that. So what we will do is we'll bring up three of the proponents, and I'll call them off shortly. Then we'll three people in opposition and go back and forth until we get through the testimony. So could I please bring up Alicia Snyder-Carlson, Troy Ainsworth, and Ingrid Hoffman. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and members of the committee. My name is Alicia Snyder-Carlson. I live near Multnomah Village in Southwest Portland. I work as a green building consultant and have a bachelor's degree in anthropology, a minor in interior architecture from the U of O, as well as a master of fine arts degree in interior design and a focus on sustainable interior design from the Savannah College of Art and Design. I am a LEED accredited professional, an interior design teacher, professor at the Art Institute of Portland, an IIDA associate member, as well as an ASID ally member. I'm here representing myself, as well as the Interior Design Collaborative of Oregon, otherwise known as IDC Oregon. I'm the current president, and we are a grassroots organization dedicated to ensuring interior designers safeguard the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Today, you'll hear from others in support and opposition of the bill. My focus today is going to talk to you a little bit about the profession and then a little bit on the green argument. So the state of interior design has changed dramatically between the last 15 and 30 years. The content and scope of education and practice has changed dramatically, whereby today we learn our education on codes, fire codes, building codes, as well as ADA standards, which is the American Disabilities Act, right alongside architecture and engineers. As such, we have about 26 states that have registration for licensing interior designers, and as a profession, it's one of the fastest growing professions in the country. So we have three main reasons for licensing commercial interiors in the state of Oregon. Number one is consumer protection. We're the only unregulated profession in the building industry, construction and design here in Oregon. You'll hear specific examples of some of the limitations from other testifiers today. And let's see, so as I mentioned, we follow and apply building, fire, and life safety codes in our everyday practice of public and private spaces, including nursing homes, hospitals, universities, public buildings, et cetera. The second reason is it's good for business. We believe that licensing will help creep Oregon interior designers who are pursuing education in that field. In Oregon, it'll create additional opportunities for existing interior designers, especially for the majority of those designers who are small business owners as well as women. And finally, the green focus. The U.S. is shifting from new construction to existing buildings and focusing on renovations of not only government buildings but also other privately owned buildings. We've seen some major need in Oregon with a state building in Bend needing costly upgrades to make ADA renovations and other code issues. And we feel that it's time for Oregon to set the stage for the next generation of commercial interior designers. We have the knowledge and qualifications to specify low-emitting materials that help create better indoor air quality as well. And to summarize, we believe licensure is necessary to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public, as well as to provide an avenue to practice to the fullest extent of our knowledge. Licensing, we believe, should not affect residential interior design, retail interior design, architects, contractors, or other professionals who are licensed under their own profession in this state. Effective and well-crafted licensure for commercial interior design would not close the door on any form of interior design practice. Rather, it would create an additional path to pursue building permits for independent interior designers. And we feel this is accomplished through carefully crafted exemptions in the grandfathering period. And lastly, to close my statement, we believe regulation would provide job opportunities in jurisdictions that have permitting barriers and create competition in a down economy. Oregon interior designers account for about 739 jobs in the state and more than 1,500 other jobs supporting the industry and related trades and workmanships. All of these are important for Oregon's economy and jobs. We have numerous examples of great commercial interior design here, and people visit from all around the world to see those designs. Supporting the industry and setting the stage for growth is not only good for business for interior designers, but also the state. We urge you to approve Senate Bill 1521. Thank you.
Chair Shields and Vice Chair George and members of the committee, my name is Troy Ainsworth. I'm a principal with FFA Architecture and Interiors in Portland. I'm a licensed architect in the state of Oregon, and our firm provides design services in architecture and interior design. I'm here to speak in support of this bill. I think it's a great idea, and I think it's been a long time coming. Interior designers are an integral part of many full-service architecture firms in Oregon and across the country. In the case of our firm, we are a multidisciplinary group that features architecture, planning, historic preservation, and interior design services. Interior designers in this professional setting focus their efforts on the planning and design of all types of interior environments. Some of the projects are tenant improvements, which create new spaces and working environments in existing buildings, while for other projects, the interior designer is part of the overall design team for the project. Other areas of building design practice that interior designers specialize in include the layout, design, and specifications for custom design and manufacturers' standard furnishing systems. In addition, interior designers investigate and determine finishes, colors, and materials for the interior environments we are creating. The areas of design that architects focus on deal with the overall planning and design of buildings, their site, floor plans, exterior appearance and materials, structural, mechanical, electrical, plumbing systems, and basic interior planning. Traditionally, the architect has the primary responsibility for the building design, meeting the basic requirements of all the applicable building and zoning codes for the project. The architect's duty to the public is to assure that the health, safety, and welfare of the public is met through the design of each project. This varies significantly from project to project in our firm. On buildings where the interior designer is the lead, or the interior component of the work is a large percentage of the work, we make sure that the interior designer responsible for that project assists during the construction phase. We assure that they have input regarding contractor questions, submittals, and that they visit the site to review installed conditions. On projects where we've developed the furnishings and equipment package, the interior designer responsible for that scope performs a final review and punch list of the work. Licensing of interior designers will be a great benefit to our practice.
because projects that the interior designer is the lead on will be handled completely by that designer. Currently, a licensed architect is involved to review and take responsibility for the work by stamping and signing the drawings that are submitted for a building permit. Many of these projects are all interior design work that does not involve structural or other types of engineering. Our interior designers are very experienced at planning and design for interior spaces that meet or exceed requirements of the building code. We feel that if the client project relies on our interior designers for their professional knowledge and that those interior designers are utilizing the same standards of practice and referencing the same requirements that the architects are, they should be recognized through a practice act leading to licensing for their professional services. Many professional service firms have become more and more diverse in the last 10 years, and ours reflects this trend by offering a range of design services to our clients. Having our interior designers licensed will only improve their and our standing in the design community. Lastly, I'd just like to say that I think it's time for interior designers to be licensed professionals as well, and it's a win-win. It's not either or. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sophman, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Oh, sorry. My name is Ingrid Hoffman. I am an interior designer, sole proprietor of InSpace Design in Portland. I have an undergraduate degree from Stanford in architectural engineering, a graduate certificate in interior design from UCLA. I am NCIDQ certified lead AP, and I am a certified interior designer in California. I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 1521. It is my belief that a practice act for state-registered interior designers will serve to protect both consumers and to support small businesses. Interior design spans a very diverse spectrum of services, home decor, residential remodels, commercial improvements. Many of these services do not need any sort of regulation, but many states and most building departments recognize the need of licensure for those who work on commercial projects. Design of commercial spaces have significant impacts on the safety and welfare of those who work or visit there. Concrete examples of issues that I would deal with in any commercial design project: occupancy requirements and limits, means of egress signage for emergency exiting. In terms of public health, selection of non-toxic finishes, appropriate surfaces and transitions to avoid accidents, ergonomics of work areas for employee comfort and productivity and health, public welfare, natural daylighting and ventilation, accessibility, sustainability. Addressing these regulations is more than just looking up rules in code books. A designer must integrate the requirements into efficient and effective functioning spaces, meeting the client needs, and ideally creating an aesthetically pleasing space. Business owners, employees, and customers should be protected knowing that commercial project designers have the necessary expertise to properly address safety and welfare issues within the context of good design. When I moved back home to Oregon in 2008, my first job was a large tenant improvement in downtown Portland. The client liked my work and was very happy with my references, but I almost lost the job when I told him that I could not permit the project as the size of the space required an architect's stamp. Despite the qualifications and credentials I'd spent many years working to obtain, I could not complete the job despite being totally willing to take on the responsibility and liability of my work. I had all the knowledge and skills to successfully complete the job, but had to pay a significant percentage of my fee to an architect for his stamp to buy legitimacy. This practice act would provide that legitimacy so interior designers, most of whom are small businesses, sole proprietors, and partnerships, would be able to compete and do the jobs that we have been trained to do. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Sure.
Senator Buchholz.
I just have a quick question. I get the thing about licensing stamps, all that, so on and so forth. The bill creates a board, hires an executive director, so on and so forth. I mean, in state, an ED is going to be $150,000. You're probably talking another $120,000 in expenses. That's $270,000 a year. That's going to be an awful steep fee. Is there some for the number of folks like you out there? The question is there another way to solve the problem without, you know, creating a new board, a new thing, and you guys paying $1,000 a year fee?
If I may, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and members, We are open to the idea of a joint board or a sub-board under maybe the building codes board, Oregon specialty structures, maybe even landscape architects or the architecture board.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you very much for showing up here today and talking about this, but here's my concern. As you've heard in the earlier board discussions we've had, we have a lot of unbelievably talented people right now who are unemployed. And we've created so many boards and restrictions on who can enter fields that it looks, at least from my perspective, that what we do is we create these boards and as a way to create a barriers to entry to people who may compete against us. So fundamentally, unless I saw some big public purpose, like there was consumer complaints or things like that that would drive this, I view these as nothing more than an industry trying to protect itself from competition. You all bring up a very interesting point, which is your block then, you're out seeking architect stamps. So you're being forced to pay a fee for the same thing. And I would say that rather than going about this particular bill where you're actually asking to create another barrier of entry for people who compete with you, what we may do is look at a scope of practice where we look at the architects and say maybe some of these activities don't necessarily need an architect stamp, but instead we create something within them just so that you guys can do some of their work without necessarily meeting all their qualifications. So I would simply suggest that from my perspective, I would say that you go a different direction with the bill, and rather than creating a barrier of entry for your field, you basically look and see if there's not a way that we couldn't open up other fields to you in that process. So just a word of advice from my perspective.
May I respond?
Sure.
So as we've currently written the bill, we have a number of exemptions that would basically ensure that residential interior designers, retail personnel working with maybe Home Depot and providing services within that environment, as well as otherwise licensed professionals, and an exemption for multi-family housing in the sense that a unit, a condominium, or a residential unit would be exempt from needing a qualified professional or a licensed professional. Anywhere where you're going to impact the egress or health, safety, and welfare of the public, like the corridors, that would be require the licensed professional. So we feel that it is not actually limiting entry into the field. This is what we are learning in school. It's the career path that's set out in front of us that we're told is available to us that is not currently available in the state. And in terms of going another route with the AIA or the architecture community, that nationally the AIA opposes regulation of interior designers. So we look for support from independent architects as well as architecture firms, and how they feel that it would benefit their business. So I appreciate the comment to pursue other avenues. The architecture statute is not the right answer for us, in my opinion.
Thank you for your response. Could we please, thank you very much for your testimony. Could we please bring up Cindy Robert, John Cornyn, and Dan Curtis.
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert and I represent the American Institute of Architects. We represent 1,300 members in Oregon. And overall, I would say to you that we have excellent relationships with our interior designers. We have many firms that have interior designers on staff, but I would tell you this bill is opposed by AIA. Real quickly, I want to just bring up the fact that many of you asked about this difference between Title Act and Practice Act. A Title Act in law says, which the interior designers just told you there's 26 states that have a Title Act, which is true, but a Title Act says you cannot call yourself something unless you meet these credentials. And a Practice Act says you cannot even do these things unless you meet these credentials. That is what this bill is. You cannot do these activities unless you meet these credentials. Historically, this type of Practice Act has been reserved for those professions that, if unregulated, have the potential to harm the public. I would submit to you that this particular profession does not rise to that level. You've heard some conversations about the protection that they will do through building codes, egress, ADA compliance. Nowhere in this legislation does it say anything about interior designers learning about the building codes in Oregon. As a matter of fact, there's a reciprocity statement within this legislation that allows those who are registered in other states to come here and practice as well without learning about our building codes. This is actually the problem. As was pointed out, architects are exempt from this law. But this is the problem. It blurs the responsibility, the accountability to your constituents for building codes. Who is to meet those? Right now, anything that requires health, safety, bless you, Senator, health, safety, welfare issues is already regulated with architects. They already do that work. There's no reason to add another layer of someone who doesn't even have to understand the code to the stamping process. If an interior designer can stamp a plan and submit it for a permit to a local government or the state building codes without knowing building codes, this doesn't make sense. How can you stamp what you don't know? This is our biggest problem. It blurs that line. And certainly, the interior designers themselves understand that this piece of legislation does not require them to have such knowledge or accountability because they themselves have said to their members this would not make them need to have liability insurance. Without liability insurance, who are you accountable to? Every construction trade, contractor, engineer, architect has liability insurance or bonds. This bill does not require this group to have that either. So I ask, if a building fails and the plans are stamped by an interior designer, who does that fall to? And furthermore, because there is no public outcry for this piece of legislation, I doubt you've heard from your constituents that they've been harmed by a decorator, I would certainly say that we have to be careful that we don't close out people who want to do this for a living, that we don't cut short people's jobs because we require them to do more than they currently do for their education. I mean, I've talked to you all about this before. I'm not going to say any more. I appreciate your time.
Good morning. My name is John Cornyn. I am here representing the Cornyn Fasano Group, which is a food service management and operations consulting firm in Portland. And we have been in business for 36 years as consultants. And I'm here also representing the Food Service Consultant Society of the Americas, and which represents both management consultants as well as kitchen planning consultants. Our concern with this bill is that it's an attempt to be a one-size-fits-all, and we think that that is really an erroneous assumption on the basis that there are niche specialties such as kitchen design that require special background, highly technical skills around some of the things that were brought up earlier, around ventilation, food and health safety, employee safety, all of the codes that go into proper food service design and equipment specification. And that saying that interior designers only can design kitchens, I think is really a fallacious position to have given the highly technical nature of this. I would suggest to you that the same rule may apply to a factory such as Intel in terms of chip manufacturing. That, does that mean that all interior design could design for Intel in that kind of a situation, or a doctor's office? We are in a world of niche specialty consultants, and we ask that you recognize that this is an important component of health and safety for our citizens, and that this bill is really, and I think was brought up by Senator George, an attempt to perhaps be a job preservation as opposed to in representing our members here in Portland and elsewhere in the area, a job destruction. You would literally take a number of consultants who are highly qualified to design food service facilities out of business if this bill were to pass. So I respectfully ask that this bill to be defeated. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Shields and the rest of the committee members. My name is Dan Curtis. I'm the president and majority owner of Curtis Restaurant Equipment, located in Springfield. We also have offices in Bend, Medford, and Beaverton. In 1995, our company was recognized as the National Food Service Equipment Dealer of the Year. Senate Bill 1521 would prohibit our company from engaging in commercial kitchen design. We've been doing kitchen design work since 1963. When our company was founded by my father almost 50 years ago. Our company is in the business of designing, equipping, and installing commercial food service facilities. These facilities range from small mom-and-pop restaurants, regional chain accounts, hospitals, hotels, retirement homes, anywhere a commercial food service kitchen is required. Our annual sales exceed $20 million in food service equipment and supplies. Over 70% of that volume comes from projects, either new construction or remodels. Our design staff of three is responsible for designing the majority of those projects, typically over 60 projects per year. Our design staff has combined over 40 years' experience designing kitchens. We follow all state, local, and federal codes. If you talk to a health department in Jackson County, Josephine County, Deschutes, Lane, Lynn, any jurisdiction in the state, they would be familiar with our plans and would say they were professional and well done. Curtis Restaurant Equipment is proud to have helped many small businesses begin. Almost daily, customers will call or walk into one of our facilities requiring help designing a commercial kitchen. They come to us for our expertise. We can quickly assess their needs, and by providing a kitchen layout and a budget, they can quickly decide whether to proceed or not proceed, or help them decide whether to proceed or not proceed with their plans. Only a food service equipment dealer can do this. Without our expertise, many of these businesses would find it very difficult and costly to get started. Curtis Restaurant Equipment currently employs 50 people. Most of our staff has worked for us for over 20 years. Our annual payroll exceeds $2 million. Our lead designer is Soon Lee. He's here today. Soon is a refugee from Vietnam. He came here when he was 17 years old in 1981. He's worked for us since 1989. Soon is one of the very best commercial kitchen designers in the Northwest and recognizes that. This bill would not allow Soon to continue to do his job in the state of Oregon. That is simply not right. This is no time to eliminate jobs and make it more difficult and costly to start a business. If passed, this bill would devastate our company, a 50-year-old company with 50 employees. Our customers can order a refrigerator on the internet. They can't get their restaurant designed. Please protect the rights of Curtis Restaurant Equipment employees and other food service equipment professionals in Oregon to earn a living and reject this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Cindy,
yes.
What about the issue that Ms. Hoffman brought up, that where she's done 90% of work and then she has to give presumably $500 or $1,000 to an architecture firm to really just sign off on it? Do you think that that needs to be addressed or not so much?
Chair Shields, I'm sure that this is an area that could be addressed. I would say to you, however, that this body enacted the Practice Act for Architects and made a decision on what they thought was important and what they thought should be restricted. That being said, we have moved into a different world. We're all working harder on sustainability issues, and perhaps the sustainability issues should be looked at as maybe blurring the need for an architect and moving into some other field. However, the most important thing is that you cannot give this new industry a stamp. You cannot give someone recognition through a stamp when they haven't don't have the accountability or the education for the stamp. Other things, yes. Absolutely. But not, you can't stamp for building codes when you're not trained in them. It doesn't make sense.
All right, thank you. Could we please bring up Sermon Yasida, Deborah Souza, and Nancy Hiss. And anything you can do to keep your testimony concise so that we can hear from everybody would be much appreciated.
Thank you, Chair Shields and Vice Chair George, members of the committee. My name is Sharmeen Yashilada. I am a senior designer at a firm called Bainbridge in Portland, Oregon, and I am a resident of the Westmoreland neighborhood in southeast Portland. Bainbridge has been practicing commercial interior design for since 1983. We are a woman-owned firm with five employees. Some of our clients are Providence Health and Services, the State of Oregon, Nike, Wells Fargo Bank, and Portland State University. Each of these types of projects has unique requirements and codes requiring trained professionals in commercial interior design. My training includes a degree in interior architecture from the University of Oregon. I am a certificate holder of the National Council for Interior Design Qualification and a Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design accredited professional. I also have 6 years of experience in commercial interior design. Today I would like to describe my firm's challenges in practicing interior design due to the lack of licensing for commercial interior designers. Much of our work includes space that is planning and preparation of construction documents for interior remodels that require building permits. The architecture statute, ORS 671 section 030, does not limit a person from planning, designing, specifying, or supervising the alterations or repairs to a building if the structural part of the building is not changed, the occupancy of the building is not changed, or the type of construction of the building is not changed. However, the problem is that there are inconsistencies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction on the requirements of a registered design professional stamping and submitting those drawings for permit. As an example, we've worked with Wells Fargo Bank for over 22 years and completed over 300 branches throughout the Northwest. They use us because we understand their specific requirements, which include unique challenges and federal regulations governing teller row design, security cameras, ATM installation, and sight lines in terms of space planning for security. These are very technical requirements requiring a set of special skills. In some cities, we are easily able to permit these drawings, such as for my firm, maybe it's because of our familiarity with the buildings department, but we are able to submit plans easily for non-structural interior projects that do not change in occupancy. However, in the cities of Bend and Eugene, the permit office has been very strict in requiring that registered design professional stamp, so we cannot do those projects. Additionally, we're further limited because we cannot hire an architect in-house. We have to contract underneath, or the client has to hire the architecture firm directly. This results in a duplication of our work, loss of fees for my firm, and extra cost for the client. The architecture firm will need to backtrack and complete some of the work we've already done, such as site verification and space planning. Our firm does not want to have to hire an additional firm that doesn't understand their needs. It's an added cost, and the local firms don't have that knowledge. If commercial interior designers were to become licensed, registered design professionals, this would increase business opportunities for independent commercial interior designers, such as mine, and allow our clients to hire the firm they trust. I feel that Senate Bill 1521 appropriately addresses this need without limiting other fields of interior design because of the carefully crafted exemptions and grandfathering language, which I have personally helped work on. I ask that you approve this measure for the protection of Oregon citizens and increase job opportunities for the Oregon interior design profession. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Shields and Vice Chair George and committee member. My name is Deborah Souza, and I have practiced commercial interior design in Portland for the past 32 years. I currently manage an interior design business in Portland, which provides design services for commercial and public facilities. I hold a Bachelor of Arts degree from an accredited interior design program from Washington State University. I'm certified through NCIDQ, a professional member of IIDA, and an advisor position on the Board of Interior Design Collaborative. My business is also registered through the Office of Minority, Women, and Emerging Small Businesses. Today I have the privilege to speak to you regarding Senate Bill 1521, a bill which will provide state certification to qualified interior design professionals. As the owner of a small business, I believe I will be positively impacted by licensing. The following points will demonstrate the effect this bill will have on my business. This bill will provide me credentials equivalent to other design professionals. I often work alongside and often lead regulated professionals, and it only makes sense for the interior design component to be regulated as well. I will continue to work independently as a professional, separate from an architectural firm. This will reduce the regulatory burden as services that can be safely provided and certified by a properly educated interior designer need not be performed or supervised by an architect. To market design services as a registered interior designer will enable me to ensure consumers that they are working with a qualified, reliable design professional, utilizing the latest information regarding health, safety, and welfare. This will also provide a growth opportunity for my firm. Registration will allow me to compete for out-of-state and government jobs that require a licensed professional and bring those dollars back to Oregon. And I will continue to provide competitive design fees by not having to hire a licensed architect to oversee and stamp my documents. In summary, as a small business owner and practicing interior designer, registration will be of high benefit to me as a professional, a benefit to my business through the added qualification definition, and a benefit to the state of Oregon as we professionally service our communities and new business to ensure health, safety, and welfare of the public. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and the committee. I brought my name is Nancy Hiss. I'm a registered architect. I am an NCIDQ certificate holder and the director of the Interior Design Program at Merrillhurst University. I brought the Oregonian from last Wednesday, which features the new hospital at Emmanuel. The article does a very good job of noting health and welfare qualities that commercial interior designers brought to this project. Quote, comfort and convenience for patients and their loved ones are taking center stage in keeping with research on the effects of the environment on healing. Studies showing patients' view of nature and sunlight recover sooner, suffer fewer complications, and require less pain medication. The article also notes well-designed acoustics, the psychological benefits of accommodating the family and providing access to fresh air and play. The photograph shows benefits of biophilic design, healing colors, and integrated artwork. This is the work of professional commercial interior designers. This is what professional interior design education teaches, and this is what the NCIDQ exam evaluates. If there is an earthquake in this building, we would all be confident in the integrity of the structural system because the engineers who designed it are licensed professionals. If there's any emergency, we would be confident the occupants of the building could exit safely because the architects who designed the exit ways are licensed professionals. If there's a fire in this building, how do we know that the occupants will be protected from smoke inhalation because of the correct specification of finished materials and furnishings? This is part of the expertise. This is part of codes are taught in interior design schools. This is what interior designers are taught by training, experience, and examination. Health, safety, and welfare is what SB 1521 is all about, and I hope you support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just have one quick question.
Focus.
And it's not related to your testimony, Ms. Hiss, but do you, because I wrote a note down here and I'm sure staff does not know, do you recall, you said you're a licensed architect, what's the yearly licensing fee for that now in Oregon?
Well, it's on a biannual, I believe it's $200.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Patty Morrow, Robin Regisi Fisher, and Diane Plessy.
Time session.
10:30.
Smokes.
Okay. If you guys need to go, that's fine.
We're skipping. You know, you're party abandoned here. We'll stay with you. Get out of the corner. Besides that, we're missing caucus.
We could excuse.
We're not moving it, so we don't need a quorum.
You can go first. No.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having us. Welcome. Good morning. Welcome. There you go.
My name is Robin Rigby Fisher, and I'm a certified master of kitchen and bath design. I am also a CAPS certified designer, which means I'm a certified aging in place specialist. I'm a residential interior designer, and I also am an instructor, an adjunct instructor at Portland Community College. So what does a residential interior designer have to do with this bill? Well, it does a lot. I am not a commercial designer. I don't do commercial applications, but I do remodel and design, or I design for residential condominiums, and that actually falls under commercial applications. This would greatly affect my opportunity to work in Portland because I do an awful lot of commercial or condominium work. The main argument for this bill is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. We already have codes for that. We have the IRC, which is the International Remodeling Code, and we have local and state jurisdictions that already tell us how we have to work. For those reasons, I am opposed to this bill. With our unemployment rate being as high as it is, and a lot of people out of work, I think this is a big factor. I think passing this bill will put a lot of people out of work and cause more problems for us. I am also an instructor at Portland Community College, and our two-year certification, which, by the way, Portland Community College is a state college. It is not a private college. By passing this bill, you would put my students out of an opportunity to be able to have a job because they would not be able to apply for the educational qualifications for this bill. For those reasons, I urge you to vote against this. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify here today. My name is Patty Morrow, and I'm the president of the Interior Design Protection Consulting Group. Our headquarters is in New Hampshire, but I am here today to testify on behalf of more than 500 members of the design community who do not meet the proposed one-size-fits-all restrictions of this regulation. This includes interior designers, interior decorators, office furniture dealers, and the entire food service equipment industry. Restraint of trade is defined as actions that are designed to interfere, eliminate, stifle competition, create a monopoly, artificially inflate prices, or otherwise hamper or obstruct the course of free trade. That is exactly what will happen here if this bill is enacted. I want to just really quickly answer four questions that you need to know before you make a decision on that bill. Where's the need? Where's the public outcry? Who benefits and who bears the cost? Where's the need? You heard testimony today that interior design protection is needed to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. There is not a shred of evidence to warrant a conclusion that the unregulated practice of interior design in any way harms the public. 12 government agencies have already researched this issue, and without any exception, every single one of those reports concluded that interior design regulation would add nothing to the protection of the public. You also heard testimony that 26 states have regulated interior design. That is not true. Only 3 other states have a practice act, and this is a practice act that is being introduced here today. Only 3 other states, Florida, Louisiana, and Nevada, have enacted practice acts, and all of those were enacted more than 20 years ago. Where's the public outcry? This bill has come about exclusively through the efforts of industry insiders, not as a result of public demand, not as a result of legislative determinations that this is necessary for the public good. There has been no public outcry from consumers saying that they are confused or harmed by unregulated interior designers. The public certainly has the means to be able to evaluate who best fits their project. So exactly who does benefit from this regulation? Well, according to the NCIDQ's own website, this is the exam needed to be licensed, they have on their website something called the Q search, where the public can go to their website to find a NCIDQ certified interior designers in their state. In the entire state of Oregon, there are only 36 listed on the exam's Q search. That represents less than 6.5% of the interior designers in the state, and that doesn't even include the rest of the design community that's also impacted. You heard testimony today from Curtis Equipment. They have 50 employees in the state. Just in this one company alone is 50 employees. That's more than the 36 that would benefit from this bill. They also have annual sales of $20 million. And I might add, the art instructor also, when she was talking about that hospital, Curtis Equipment worked on the in that hospital, on the commercial kitchen on that hospital. So who bears the cost? Well, the consumers for sure. The Federal Trade Commission studied this issue on two separate occasions. They concluded that consumers would be negatively impacted, it would increase cost, and offer fewer choices to consumers.
Could I ask you to summarize your testimony, just because we've got a number of people that still need to, get on?
Creating the new state board with a $3 billion deficit is not a good idea. This is about jobs. No legitimate government interests will be served if this bill is enacted. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Senator Shields and committee members. My name is Diane Placid, and I am the owner and operator principal of DP Design. I've had this business for 28 years. My professional credentials include being a certified master kitchen bath designer, a certified aging-in-place specialist, and an NCIDQ certified designer. That is, I could qualify to meet their restrictions, but I'm against this because I'm a consumer advocate. There is nothing in this world that I care more about personally and professionally than consumers. And I feel that this bill is absolutely wrong for consumers, because if it gives the commercial interior designers the right to schedule their own bills, their own invoices, because they're limited, who's going to pay? Who's going to pay for the regulatory board? Is it going to come from their taxes? Yes. And what happens when there's restraint of free trade? It goes down. Quality goes down, prices go up when people know they're guaranteed of an income. As for signing plans, in the state of Oregon, architects and licensed contractors can submit plans, and structural engineers can stamp and approve plans. Why do interior designers need the right to stamp plans if a contractor's involved in a project? Why can't they hand the plans over, like I do, to a contractor and say, here are the plans, submit them, and get the permits? If a contractor can do it, why do they need to pay an architect to stamp and approve their plans? And every project that I've been hearing about today through all the testimony is involving a contractor. It's about commercial construction, commercial development, commercial redevelopment. That has to have a contractor involved. So where is the argument? What's the need? What's the impact on the people of Oregon? What's the impact on the profession of interior design? I really, really strongly state that I am opposed to this bill. As long as I carry a breath, I'm opposed to this bill. And I urge you to please vote against this bill.
Thank you. Good testimony. Carla Green, and then I'm afraid we're only going to have time for Ed Nagorski, Randy Krebs, and Tony Hyde after that, and again, only if they can be concise.
Thank you, Senator Shields, Chairman Shields, and the dwindling committee. My name is Carla Green. I'm an allied ASID member. I'm the co-owner of Green and Milligan Design, and I'm a member of the ORA, the Oregon Remodelers Association. I'm a residential interior designer, and I'm a co-owner of a design, build, remodel firm. We're contractors, and I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 1521. About 12 years ago, I made a decision when my youngest child was going off to college that it was my turn to
turn to return to school and finally finish my degree. I came from that era of the college dropout of the 60s. Now I have my Bachelor of Fine Arts in Interior Design from Merrillhurst University. Merrillhurst prepares their graduates for commercial design business, but I have chosen to work primarily in residential remodeling, which means we design the project, we're a design build firm, and we are the general contractors. So you might ask, why am I here testifying for commercial interior design legislation? My aha moment came to me when I asked myself that same question. I realized that requiring more from designers, meeting the education, experience, and examination requirements, will set a standard of expectations for the public and clients. Most people know what an architect does, what an engineer does, what a landscape architect does. Very few understand what interior designers do. Perhaps that's why interior designers are the only members of this construction and building profession that is not licensed. If we truly only specified colors and decor, might not be necessary. But interior designers, and especially commercial interior designers, must have a vast amount of knowledge about what is required to ensure that health, welfare, and safety of the public, and be able to design what the client needs within those parameters. The phrase health, welfare, and safety of the public has been heard a lot. And what does that mean? For me, it means that within the design of a space, the designer has to make sure that the occupant's health is not compromised, that you can use the space for what your needs are, and use it well, and that they are safe in all conditions. All of that is hidden in the final product, which hopefully is perceived as successful and beautiful. My age, my general life experiences, and specific knowledge have led me here today. As a residential designer, as a mother, as a grandmother, as a member of the community, I'm strongly in favor of this legislation. I want to feel secure in commercial spaces, that the designer knew what materials to specify, how wide to make the hallways, how to ensure the safety of firefighters, and that I am breathing non-toxic air. By the way, if my stepson asks me to remodel his orthodontic office, I'll have to take that exam or recommend a licensed commercial interior designer, which would in fact spread the work out and not hold it back. There are those that will argue against licensure.
Excuse me on the screen. Can I ask you to please summarize?
I'm summarizing right now. Thank you. It's interesting to me that as far as I know, most of all those groups have their own requirements of education, experience, and examination, and fees. Some tout their own professional members and certifications, which require expensive books and first-party exams. The general public only knows what they see and hear. Licensing imparts a positive recognition in the public eye and in the workplace. I believe the integrity of the interior profession can only become stronger with this legislation, stronger for the profession, stronger for the public, stronger for you and me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ed Nagorski, Randy Krebs, and Tony Hyde. And unfortunately, that's going to be the last one.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krebs has a way of testifying.
Oh, thank you.
And I'll try to be brief. I'm sorry. I'll be very brief. I know you're out of time. My name is Ed Nagorski. I'm with the National Kitchen and Bath Association, representing 644 members here in the state of Oregon. You've heard a lot of testimony, and I'm sure there are more people I would like to testify that won't have a chance today. You've heard from the Interior Design Coalition supporting the bill. You've heard from architects. You've heard from food equipment service manufacturers and independent designers. But there's one group that you haven't heard from today. You haven't heard from the public. If this is truly a health, safety, welfare concern for the general public, they would be here. They would have sent you letters. The Attorney General's Office or Division of Consumer Affairs or consumer advocacy groups would have been calling on you to protect the public from all of these unqualified designers. Instead, the only ones crying out for protection are a small group of interior designers asking you to protect them from their competition. This is not a health, safety, welfare issue. If it were, you wouldn't have an exemption for a retail showroom that may have an 18-year-old right out of high school eligible now to design a commercial project. There are designers out there that you've heard from today that have many, many years and decades of experience that this bill would impact. There's no public purpose in it. There's no reason for it other than to protect a small group of designers from fair market competition. And I'd urge you to not pass Senate Bill 1521. Allow the free market to decide who they wish to hire to design their space. Thank you.
Thank you for testifying.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tony Hyde, Columbia County Commissioner. I'm not going to bore you with my long resume and make sure that my resume is not as long as my testimony. I just want to say that we have companies that are downstream from Curtis and others that you've heard of, that we manufacture things in Columbia County. We create traded sector products. And this would affect us to the tune of at least 50 or 60 jobs. And I would submit to you that the interior designers are not the protagonists in this issue. It's economic development. We've been talking a lot on both the national and state level on reducing regulations so that we can manage economic development in a more sustainable and in a way that we can compete with other states. This only adds another layer. We do not need fashion police in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, and I do apologize to those who came to tell us your point of view. It seems like that the only people left to testify are those who were testifying against, and I think the main reason that you all came here is so that we wouldn't move the bill forward. This is what democracy looks like. We've heard that there are a lot of concerns about this bill. I think the people who are in favor of it have made the best case they could, too. I think this is going to need some more work over the interim and certainly to get through this building. So I do appreciate you all coming forward to vet these issues with us. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1521, and this meeting is adjourned.